From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Actress Elaine Stritch has had a brilliant career on Broadway. Noel Coward wrote the musical Sail Away for her, and she starred in Stephen Sondheim's Company and Woody Allen's September. On this edition of Fresh Air, Elaine Stritch, now in the current PBS production Sense and Sensibility, tells us why a few belts are no good when you have to belt one out. Also today, writer Ann Beatty tells us how her characters evolve from details in her new novel, Picturing Will. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz appreciates pianist Leonard Schur, and linguist Jeffrey Nunberg examines our use of Mr., Mrs., and Ms., or is it our misuse? And unless we've missed something, that's all ahead on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The House voted overwhelmingly today to override President Bush's veto of legislation protecting Chinese students from deportation. The House vote of 390-25 sent the matter to the Senate, where both sides say the outcome of tomorrow's scheduled vote is in doubt. At a news conference, President Bush said the bill is unnecessary. It will damage long-term relationships with China. The president also covered a number of other topics, as NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
In a move sure to please environmentalists, the president announced that the Environmental Protection Agency will be elevated to a cabinet department. He said the second phase of his administration's strategy to fight drugs would be unveiled tomorrow, and Mr. Bush also announced plans to begin restructuring the U.S. military in the wake of the dramatic changes in the Soviet Union.
A new strategy that is more flexible, more geared to contingencies outside of Europe, while continuing to meet our inescapable responsibility to NATO and to maintaining the global balance.
Asked about Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's problems in the Soviet ethnic republics, President Bush said it's in the U.S. interest that Gorbachev survives, stays strong, and goes forward. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Thousands of Russian citizens were evacuated from Soviet Azerbaijan today as Azerbaijanis fired on Soviet forces in Baku Harbor from merchant ships. The Azeris were finally routed and forced to lift a five-day-old sea blockade of the city. Meanwhile, soldiers rounded up 43 activists and banned rallies in Baku. Red Army soldiers moved into the Azerbaijani capital on Saturday. Riot police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse 40,000 ethnic Albanians demanding the lifting of a state of emergency in Kosovo. The BBC's Jim Fish reports from Belgrade. The demonstrators say they will call a general strike if their demands are not met.
For most of the day, a growing crowd of demonstrators, mainly from the province's ethnic Albanian majority, has besieged the provincial headquarters in the capital Pristina, chanting slogans against the Kosovo government. Their main demand now appears to be the resignation of both the government and the Communist Party leaderships in the province. Earlier, Belgrade Radio said their demands included the release of political prisoners and an end to emergency measures, which have been enforced in the province since unrest last March culminated in the death of more than 20 people in clashes between police and demonstrators. The Communist Party head in the province, Mr. Rahman Morina, tried to address the demonstrators, but he was shouted down. The demonstrators have threatened a general strike in the province if their demands are not met by Friday.
The BBC's Jim Fish. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 11 points today to close at 2604.5. This is NPR News. A Miami police officer was sentenced to 7 years in prison today for the deaths of two black men in an incident that touched off 3 days of racial violence a year ago. William Lozano was convicted last month of two counts of manslaughter for fatally shooting an unarmed black motorcyclist on a street in the Overtown section. Lozano is free on bond pending appeal. Police say the city is quiet tonight after the sentencing. A two-day international conference in Geneva ended today without agreement on how to deal with the continuing outflow of Vietnamese boat people. The accord fell through when the U.S. refused to budge on its insistence on a one-year moratorium on deportation of boat people from Southeast Asian countries. Burton Bolag has details.
Officials say agreement was very near, especially since the United States announced yesterday that it had dropped its long-term opposition to deporting those boat people in Southeast Asia determined to be economic migrants. The other approximately 25 countries at the meeting had reached a compromise under which deportations would begin next July, but But the accord fell through when the United States stuck to its demand that no boat people be sent back before next year. The meeting has asked the UN High Commissioner for Refugees to try urgently to get the U.S. to show more flexibility. Privately, UN refugee officials warn that if no compromise is found, the current international understanding on the boat people could fall apart, with even political refugees fleeing persecution no longer being allowed to land in Southeast Asian countries. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Geneva.
President Bush said today he mourns the loss of innocent civilians in the U.S. invasion of Panama, but officials say he is not expected to offer any compensation to their families in his Panama recovery package. The White House is expected to announce the package this week. If it is completed, Vice President Dan Quayle could take the specifics when he travels to Panama this weekend for talks with the new government. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson, here from San Francisco, while Terry Gross continues her midwinter break. My guest today is the actress and singer Elaine Stritch. Her performances in Pal Joey and Bus Stop attracted the attention of film producer David Selznick, who cast her in Farewell to Arms. She was later noticed by Noel Coward, who wrote the musical Sail Away for her. Her extensive theatrical career includes appearances in the Stephen Sondheim musical Company, renowned for her rendition of The Ladies Who Lunch. She's currently in the series on cable TV called Two's Company. She's also portrayed the character of Mrs. McGee on The Cosby Show and Victoria Principal's mother in the CBS film Sparks. Woody Allen chose her to replace Maureen O'Sullivan when he needed to shoot his entire film September a second time around. In September, she portrayed an aging actress whose powerful personality overwhelmed her daughter, as portrayed by Mia Farrow. She came by to talk with us about her current role in the American Playhouse production of Sense and Sensibility by Richard Nelson. The play threads the story of a June afternoon at an Adirondack estate in 1937 with a June afternoon in 1986 at the same estate, set amongst an East Coast literary world of upper-class, leftist, political, and personal battles. Elaine Stritch portrays the character Eleanor in 1986, with Gene Simmons as Marianne and Tom Eldridge as Eddie. When she read the script with two good female roles, I asked Elaine Stritch if she actually wanted to portray the other character, Marianne.
I have finally smartened up in my career, and I have come to the conclusion that I should do as I'm told. And by that I mean that if someone who I consider to be good at his job comes to me and says, Elaine, this is a part that you should play, I play it. It was very interesting. It's taken me a long time to find this out. When I was in drama school, I did it instinctively. I listened to Irwin Piscator. I listened to Herbert Berghoff, I listened to Stella Adler, I listened to all my teachers, and I did as I was told, and I was wonderful. And as soon as I got kind of smarty pants and out on Broadway, and I think I should do this, this would be a good thing for me to do. It doesn't work that way with me. I don't want to say this, make this a general rule for young actresses or anything who may be listening to me. I just feel that I am the kind of actress that should find good people, strong people, intelligent people, good directors, good producers, and do as I'm told.
So the reputation for contentiousness that developed was from working with people who weren't good directors then.
That's right. Because if you're left all alone and you're working with people that aren't, don't know as much. You know, Noel Coward told me something very valuable one day. I didn't realize how valuable it was at the time due to my youth. But he told me never to work with people who knew less than I did. Because if I did, I would make nothing but enemies. It's a pretty strong thought there, but it's true. It really is true. If you work with people that don't know as much as you do, they're going to dislike you. Because in the course of in the working experience, it's going to come out that you're smarter than they are. And nobody who isn't smart wants anybody who's smarter around them. Have you ever noticed that?
From time to time.
Yes, they get angry. And and of course, as I said to Noel Coward, my God, where am I going to find all these smart people? You know, he said, they'll happen. Just don't work down, work up, or don't work.
Noel Coward wrote much of Sail Away for you. And
yes, he did indeed. It was one of the great experiences of my life to have a man of that stature and talent and sensitivity, and the wonder of the man was unbelievable. And to have him write a musical for you is no No small compliment, no small tribute. It was terrific.
I understand he kept expanding your role of Mimi for you, just kept expanding it. And I wonder what it was, what do you think it was that he heard in you that he wanted to write for?
I think Noel discovered that a woman who is funny can also be vulnerable and sensitive and frightened and, you know, all those other good things. And I think he loved the combination of a woman who, you know, funny women aren't supposed to fall in love. Have you ever noticed that? They're just supposed to be the life of the party, but they're never supposed to, you know, have a serious relationship with the opposite sex. I've always found that. I think it's changing now. God knows. You know, it was very interesting. In musical comedy especially, there used to be a funny lady and there used to be a romantic lady. And if you go back and look at your musicals, and in Noel's musicals as well, you've got, I think they used to call them soubrettes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There was always the funny lady who stopped the show, the second to closing number, right? And she was the hotsy-totsy, flirtatious, goofy broad that everybody had a good time with. I don't mean that in the sense that it might mean today. I mean, she was a barrel of laughs. And then there was terribly elegant woman appeared all over the place and just was the woman who was in love. And they were lots of violins played in the pits when she came on. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then Miss Jazzbo came on, got all the laughs, and waltzed off with nobody at the end of the... of the musical. But Noel thought it would be interesting to have that funny lady fall in love. And that's what he developed in Sail Away. And I must say it worked.
He wrote once about your performance that it was nothing short of miraculous and that you sang something very strange, so movingly that that he almost cried.
Yes,
and
well.
I'd like to...
He wasn't hard to make cry, really. I don't consider that such a tribute. He was a very sensitive man. I'm thrilled with the compliment.
I'd like for all of us to hear just a bit of that song.
Oh, lovely. Thank you very much. You've done your homework, haven't you, Sedge?
This is something very strange.
Meet me here at 8:30.
Okay, Johnny.
Okay, Mimi.
This is not a day like any other day. This is something special and apart. Something to remember when the coldness of December chills my heart. Something very strange is happening to me. Every face I see seems to be smiling.
It's a pleasure to hear that.
That was great fun. Thank you. I haven't heard it in so long. Beautiful song. I love that song. There's a line in the end of that song. Tinker, tailor, soldier, sailor, beggarman or thief, every single leaf on every tree seems to be aware of something in the air, and if only I were younger, I'd put ribbons in my hair. I think that is so wonderful. And so Noel Coward, I can't stand it. This simple, sweet side of Noel Coward. Less sophisticated side of Noel Coward. It was lovely, lovely song.
How have you used your voice differently from the time of singing in musical theater like that to working in close mic situations like the movies or television shows?
Well, I don't know. Unless I'm told to come down a peg or two, I don't pay any attention to it. I have a big voice, and I have a lot of projection in my voice. I had an experience when I did that movie with Woody Allen, which was a glorious experience.
Called September.
Yes, and I've always said that Woody Allen directs by just being there, which I think is quite a compliment. I mean, he's just there, and you want to please him. And if you've got the talent to do it, it'll happen. It's the kind of director he is. He just... His observance of you directs you. Do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's quite extraordinary.
You objected to a dress that you once had to wear.
A
couple of them. Because it didn't make you feel pretty enough to be funny.
Yes, and I said, I suppose you've heard that a million times before, Woody, but I have to look pretty in order to be funny. And he said, no, I've never heard that before. And that was his only comment, and then we went to work.
Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Well, yes, I'd be happy to, and every woman in the world will know what I'm talking about, and probably a few men. If I go to a party, for instance, and I don't look sensational, I don't open up. I mean, I don't perform well because I don't have the confidence of my body and my hair and my face and everything looking feminine and attractive and desirable and wonderful. And if I don't feel good, then I can't make anybody else feel good. You understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So did then Woody Allen allow you to look pretty?
Well, I didn't look like I wanted to look, but I was convinced that I looked right for the character. And once I get comfortable with the character, then everything's okay.
My guest is actress Elaine Stritch. She's appearing in the American Playhouse production of Sensibility and Sense. She can also be seen on The Cosby Show as Mrs. McGee. What was work on the set with Woody Allen like when particularly everybody had to do the entire movie again?
It was disciplined. It had to be disciplined because there were a lot of actresses that were there that had done it, including Mia and Diane Wiest. And that's hard to do. That's hard. And it's also hard to be a new girl in town and have to do it for the first time with people who were doing it for the second time. It was, but we got through it, and, he creates a very disciplined workmanlike atmosphere, and you want to do good for him. So I did the best I could, and he was very pleased, and so was I. I was just heartsick the movie wasn't a success. From a point of view of my career, my God, if that had been Hannah and her sisters, I'd be, I'd have a larger mantelpiece, I think. You know what I mean? I am now eating the other piece of my cake from London.
I want to ask you a bit about the cake that you're eating. You need to keep fueled up all the time.
Yes. Otherwise, I wouldn't be such a brat about all this. I have to have a little fix, as they say, every few hours because I'm a diabetic. And between, like at tea time, between lunch and supper, I have to have a little, cookie, piece of cake or something, just to make sure my blood sugar stays normal with the amount of insulin that I've taken in the morning.
You wrote a book called Living with Diabetes and Damn It, Having Fun.
Yes.
And the title also is Am I Blue?
Yes.
How did the title Am I Blue come
about? The title
about?
Came about because when you take your blood test to determine what your blood sugar is, you have these little sticks. And when the stick is nice and blue, it means your blood sugar is lovely. And when it gets real dark, 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 indigo blue, then you're in a little bit of trouble. Then you have to watch your sugar intake, or carbohydrate intake, I should say. But that's where actually my husband, who's died in 1982, and he was a very funny guy, wonderful guy, his name was John Bay, and he took my, he was looking at the stick one day, and I said from the other room, Am I Blue? And he said, that's a great title for your book. So that's what I called it.
My guest is Elaine Stritch. She's worked with Stephen Sondheim in the show Company, and Noel Coward wrote the musical Sail Away for her. She was in Woody Allen's movie September, and she's appearing in the American Playhouse production of Sensibility and Sense. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Elaine Stritch. She's starring in the American Playhouse production of Sensibility and Sense, which airs on PBS on January 24th. I was struck by the role that alcohol has played in a number of the roles that you have been in, always holding a drink, a cigarette, and I suppose especially now as a diabetic, this is something that you've had to change. What when you play somebody such as Diane in September, slowly becoming inebriated over a Ouija board,
mm-hmm.
Reminiscing about your past lovers and lives. How do you envision yourself? Do you bring something from a moment of soberness, looking at other people who've had too much to drink, or something from your own experience of having drunk a lot?
Oh, something from my own experience, absolutely. And boy, do I have a lot of that. I love to drink. I mean, it was one of my favorite things in the world. And also, it became a little bit too much of a necessity. I took a drink to go on the stage. I took a drink before I did a scene in a movie. I was dependent on alcohol, and I am not anymore. And it was a wonderful discovery, marvelous adventure I'm having at this point in my life. I was too frightened. I needed a drink in order to get courage. You know, the old, I never have understood that expression, Dutch courage, but never mind. I don't care if I ever do. But I did depend on it because it made me feel better and made me feel more courageous and gave me guts. And then I got to a diabetes, schmiabetes. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about psychologically. I got to, and emotionally, I got to a point in my life where I wanted to know whether I could do all this swell stuff without the help of a drug of any kind. And I've proven that I can, and it's made me gloriously happy.
You were cast as the role of Joanne in the Stephen Sondheim
another boozer, another boozer
in Company, and you went with and you sang about the ladies who lunch.
Absolutely, another vodka stinger.
And I'd like to remind everybody a bit about this role, the ladies who lunch.
I'd like to propose a toast. Here's to the ladies who lunch. Everybody laugh. Lounging in their caftans and planning a brunch on their own behalf. Off to the gym, then to a fitting, claiming their fat, and looking grim, 'cause they've been sitting, choosing a hat. Does anyone still wear a hat? I'll drink to that. Here's to the girls who stay smart, aren't they a gas? Rushing to their classes in optical art, wishing it would pass. Another long, exhausting day, another $1,000.
Mahler. I'll drink to that. Did you ever hear the story about the when I asked Steve Sondheim what Mahler was?
No.
I love the reading that, Sedge. I think that's one of, no. I went to him one day, and you know, Mahler was kind of ahead of his time. And of course,
we're talking Gustav here, right?
We're talking Gustav. And Steve was ahead of his time always on everything, Mr. Smartass of all time. And he thought it would be a good idea to put Mahler in his lyric because Mahler was going to become terribly well known. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know who Gustav Mahler. I didn't know that Mahler was Gustav Mahler. And when he said a piece of Mahler, there used to be a place on Broadway, I think there maybe still is, where they served Mahler pastry. This is a true story. You think I'm making it up,
uh-uh.
Don't you? All right. So I said, I thought that that meant a matinee, a Pinter play, perhaps a piece of Mahler. So these ladies go to the corner after seeing the Pinter play and have a piece of Mahler. Well, you know what he said to me? He said, I have to go to the John. And he left the room. He said, I just have to go to the bathroom, Elaine. I don't want to talk about this. He was so upset that I didn't know who Mahler was, but never mind.
My guest is actress Elaine Stritch. A cousin of yours was the Cardinal of Chicago, and you went to a Catholic girls' school growing up.
Yes, indeed. I went to the Sacred Heart Convent for 12, count them, 12 years.
That's serious Catholic upbringing.
That is serious Catholic upbringing. I tried to inject an awful lot of laughs into it, but I liked the convent. I had a good time at the convent. Gave me a lot to play against, if you know what I mean.
Do you keep in touch with any of the nuns?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I had a family not family. Oh, that's a Freudian slip. I had a school reunion 2 years ago and saw a lot of the nuns that taught me in school. It was terrific.
You've, I think, made a comment that a lot of the people that you went to the Sacred Heart Convent with sort of turned out to be sort of wild women in a way.
No. Not really. No, no wilder than I did. But I think that's an old wives' tale about being cooped up in the convent and then you get out and kick your heels up. Well, no, I don't. I guess that's exactly what I did. But the convent was fun, and it wasn't as, in my day, it wasn't as strict as, the word convent used to mean boarding school and never getting out, and it wasn't that way with me. I went to a day school, and, you know, it was just the Sacred Heart nuns. I was very fond of them. They were good teachers, and I had a wonderful time.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Elaine Stritch,
thank
for
you,
coming Sedge. In and
talking. Have you seen, needless to say, have seen Sensibility and Sense.
I got a little preview.
I want to say a word about Jean Simmons. I had such a wonderful time working with her, and I think she shows qualities in this performance that will be used in the future. She's a very, very strong actress.
The story begins in 1937, and you play characters in 1986.
86, yes.
Would you get a sense of deja vu about 1937 when watching that part of the play?
No, I had nothing to do with those women. Nothing to do with those kind of women. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean?
Or just, yeah.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. And anyway, in 1937, I hasten to add, I was 10 years old. So don't give me that I knew anything about those women, or I'll kill you. All right? But if you see Sensibility and Sense, you'll hardly believe that, but it's true. It really is true. Jean Simmons said to me on the phone the other night, she complimented me on doing a show with no makeup, because I'm dying in Sensibility and Sense. And it really isn't difficult for me. I mean, that doesn't bother me at all. But it's, you know, it's kind of scary when you start to get older and you see yourself on the screen and you're playing, really playing an old lady. I told Theoni Aldrich, who's married to Tom Aldrich, I said to get out the sequins and the high heels as soon as possible. And I want to kick my heels up again because it scares you. You know, you think, oh, my God, I'm getting to be an old lady. So the next part is going to be lots of cocktails and cigarettes and jokes and sequins, okay?
Okay. Elaine Stritch stars in the American Playhouse production of Sensibility and Sense. She also appears in the CBS film Sparks. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the author of the 87th Precinct series of crime novels, Ed McBain, who under his real name, Evan Hunter, also wrote the screenplay for the film Blackboard Jungle. I hope you can join us.
Why do the wrong people travel when the right people stay back home? What compulsion compels them, and who the hell tells them to drag their clans to Zanzibar instead of staying quietly in Omaha? The Taj Mahal and the Grand Canal and the sunny French Riviera would be less oppressed if the Middle West would settle for somewhere rather nearer. Please do not think that I criticize or cavil at a genuine urge to roam. But why do the wrong people travel?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Novelist Ann Beatty, with her keen eye for detail and character, is considered one of the leading writers of the Big Chill generation. Coming up, we meet Ann Beatty. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings by pianist Leonard Schur. Lloyd says they're among the greatest piano records of our time. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg tries to decipher the code of etiquette in showbiz for the correct use of Mr., Miss, or Ms. Detail, notes, and clarity, all ahead on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The House today gave a definite no to President Bush's veto of a bill protecting Chinese students in this country from being sent home when their visas expire. By a vote of 390-25, the House voted to override the veto and send the bill on to the Senate. During debate, Democratic Congressman Charles Schumer added his voice to those criticizing the president's policy of protecting the students by executive order only.
Mr. President, your approval ratings may be skyrocketing, but that's not going to stop Congress from doing the right thing. This House and the American people will not stand by and watch these students return to the butchers of Tiananmen Square, should your administrative remedies fail.
145 Republicans joined House Democrats in voting to override the presidential veto. Retired Air Force General Richard Secord was sentenced to 2 years probation today for lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Secord told U.S. District Judge Aubrey Robinson that he deeply regrets failing to tell Congress about the $14,000 security system he bought for former National Security aide Oliver North. Judge Robinson responded by telling Secord there has already been punishment and no need for incarceration. Afterwards, Secord said he plans to raise money to sue the Office of Independent Counsel, which brought the charges against him.
The institution of the Independent Counsel, so-called special prosecutor, is a monster at large in our criminal justice system.
So far, five Iran-Contra defendants have been sentenced, none of them to prison. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
A top savings and loan regulator delivered more bad news to Congress today. The $50 billion Congress approved to bail out the nation's savings and loans will not be enough. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The bad news is that the savings and loan bailout will be a lot more expensive than Congress thought. The good news is that lawmakers probably won't have to hand over another bill to the taxpayers until after this year's congressional elections. Congress had been warned that the cost of the bailout might grow, but today's testimony from the chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, William Seidman, was the most definitive and the most pessimistic to date. Seidman wouldn't say exactly how much it will cost to cover the S&L losses, but he suggested it could be in the $74 to $82 billion range. That's about 50% higher than the $50 billion Congress provided last August. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 11 points to close at 2,604.50 on volume of 209 million shares. Trading was heavy as declining issues led advances 4-1. At one point, the Dow Jones Industrials had been down over 60 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Pianist Leonard Schur will be 80 years old in April, and he's still performing some of the most demanding pieces of the piano repertoire. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has some thoughts about a new reissue of Leonard Schur's playing of two late Schubert sonatas.
Most of Leonard Schur's recordings come from three points in his career: the mid-1940s, the mid-50s, and recording sessions in Miami about a decade ago. The latter are among the greatest piano recordings of our time. Schur was never adventurous in his repertoire. He recorded the same central works over and over again: Beethoven, Schubert, Schumann, and Brahms, inspired by his great teacher, Arthur Schnabel, to play only what he considered the very greatest music. It's probably one of the reasons he's never been as famous as he should have been. He didn't want to play the sort of flashy virtuoso pieces that would knock an audience dead. Schur was born in Los Angeles on April 10, 1910. He was a child prodigy who would rather learn from the European masters than live the life of a professional virtuoso. By the time he was 17, he was not only Schnabel's student, but his first and only assistant. In 1933, Schur made his American debut playing the Brahms D minor concerto with the Boston Symphony. Conductor Serge Koussevitzky invited Schur to perform before he had ever heard him play a note. In 1941, Schur became the first piano soloist at Koussevitzky's new Berkshire Music Center at Tanglewood. It's fitting that his first compact disc from those recording sessions a decade ago should include two of Schubert's three great Opus Posthumus sonatas. It was Schur's teacher, Schnabel, who first established Schubert's piano sonatas in the modern concert repertoire. Here's the menuetto of the C minor. Schur's grip on the music is so powerful, it's as if he's daring you to resist him. Schur's earlier recordings were note-perfect, dazzling miniatures. The superlatively engineered performances on this audiophone disc, recorded when Schur was already 70, are more like live performances, with few, if any, splices. Schur is capable of alternating monumental power with aching intimacy. It's amazing how the same person can be so strong and so delicate. Schnabel never recorded the Schubert C minor sonata, and Schur's performance may be as close to a Schnabel performance as we'll ever get. It's a relentlessly dramatic, disturbing work. Robert Lowell once called it Schubert's Requiem for himself. The final movement is a sinister tarantella. Those descending arpeggios are like the fingers of an icy skeleton slipping down your spine. From these highly charged emotional performances, you'd probably be surprised to learn, if you've never seen Schur in person, that he barely moves when he plays. His demeanor is self-effacing, matter of fact. There's no showmanship. He looks more like a businessman than a virtuoso. But watch his feet. His pedaling is as tricky as a Fred Astaire dance routine. Sometimes you can even hear him singing along. And as in all the very greatest performances, besides singing and dancing, the music also grieves. Let's close with Leonard Schur playing the melancholy but lilting andante of Schubert's B-flat sonata, his last. Thank you.
We're listening to music from the new Audiophon compact disc with Leonard Schur performing Schubert's B-flat Sonata. Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Much of Ann Beattie's fiction is about people who grew up in the 60s. Her characters from the counterculture often are grappling with alienation. Beattie is often labeled a chronicler of her generation, a label she doesn't accept. Beattie's first New Yorker short story appeared in the early 70s, and since then she's written four novels and collected her short stories in four volumes. Her 1976 novel, Chilly Scenes of Winter, was made into a movie, later called Head Over Heels. Beattie's new novel, Picturing Will, is the story of 5.5-year-old Will and the people whose lives revolve around him. His mother, Jody, a struggling photographer raising Will alone, Will's father, Wayne, who abandoned the family when Will was a baby, and Jody's supportive boyfriend, Mel. Ann Beattie's sense of detail is photographic, and I asked her to read an excerpt written in Jody's voice that depicts the relationship with ex-husband Wayne.
The only absolutely distinct memory she had, whether she was awake or during the many times she dreamed it, was of the day they married. They had gone to a justice of the peace. His brother and a girlfriend with whom she had since lost touch had been the only witnesses. After the ceremony, she and Wayne had walked out the door with an arm around each other's waist and made a happy race for the car. His brother had overtaken them and managed to throw open the car door, bowing as if opening the door to a gilded carriage. There had been a split second when she looked down to where Wayne's fingers curved around her waist and suddenly saw their future as clearly as anyone looking into a crystal ball. His fingers were perfectly placed, but you could see how lightly their touch registered. Either the thing he touched was ephemeral, or his touch made it so. This many years later, she still wondered which. But in that instant, she had realized that she would slip through Wayne's fingers.
I think that's an incredibly visual passage that is like, a strobe light has been taken and frozen those characters and those people in that moment, the way a photographer works.
Well, terrific. I do think that photographers zoom in on a detail quite often and hope that that will evoke the entire emotion that they're hoping to get in the photograph. And I have to say that as I was writing this, once I saw that hand as distinguished from, say, the way her skirt looked or whatever, I realized that I had to say something about that hand. I mean, that in effect it was operating metaphorically, but I had to state the metaphor, or it could have worked on any number of levels. I was kind of directing the reader, I hope subtly, as to what to think about their relationship early on.
Picturing Will has a keenly drawn portrait of a young child being raised, and you yourself have chosen not to have children. I'm wondering how you got such an accurate sense of children in your book.
It wasn't hard for me to remember being a child. I think that's really the easiest answer to it. For instance, when I was trying to create the little boy's character, I realized, and I just never articulated this to myself before, never had reason to, I guess, that a child's world is composed of the things the child knows, and since there are so few things that the child knows, really strange connections are made. You know, the child has a tendency to think all these things are interrelated, and as we all know, once you get out there in that big wide world of chaos, the things are not related at all, or not so easily related as you want to make them. But there were many such moments that after having written them, I realized, that really is the way it was, that those really are the delusions under which I hopefully operated.
Mm-hmm. Some of your stories have characters in them that are lost, not quite where to turn next in life, feeling unsuccessful or extremely frustrated, dissipated in some way. Is it a drain on you to write these characters, or do you get kind of charged up by trying to explore the details of their lives?
I don't know that I'd like to have 10 of them together at one time and be sitting around having a cup of coffee with them necessarily. But in some ways, they're a problem to me, and they're a problem to be figured out. There's nothing I want to announce to the reader as being the truth of those characters, but I think that, you know, everything is more complicated than it seems. And so I hope that by the time I finish the particular story, that the particular characters in that story transcend what, from an aerial view, might have seemed like mere isolation or mere alienation to begin with. I do think of them as psychological portraits, in which, of course, I'm not a case psychologist, and so I'm not even trying to solve any sort of riddle.
Mm-hmm. What role did William Shawn have in your life as a writer?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I'm exactly where I am today because of The New Yorker. You know, it was wonderful exposure, and I certainly was richly rewarded, considering that I was living on $3,500 a year when I started publishing in The New Yorker and, you know, acting as a student teacher. William Shawn, Roger Angel, who pulled me out of the slush pile, Fran Kiernan, who was there at the time, were all incredibly supportive and obviously launched a career that I had no idea was being launched.
When you say that Roger Angel pulled a manuscript out of the slush pile, would you just send in manuscripts to The New Yorker?
Yes, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, unsolicited manuscripts that go in unagented, unrecommended, whatever. It's all called the slush pile. That is what happened. I just sent a story to The New Yorker.
How many had you sent them before they took one?
At least 20.
Uh-huh. And did they take any of the early ones later on? What became of the earlier
ones? No, they didn't.
Ones?
They didn't. I must say that they wrote me encouraging letters from the first.
I once saw a frightening scene in a restaurant in Berkeley. The editor of a magazine out there was going through her slush pile over a late lunch, and she had the stack of manuscripts that had come in that day's mail or that week's mail. And while she was eating her, I don't know, mozzarella and basil salad with mandarin oranges in it or something, she was opening up the envelopes and quickly scanning a typescript and putting it down in the stack that she was going to be sending it back, quickly putting it back in the envelope in which it had come, spending no more than 20 seconds in some cases, looking at a poem, looking at a manuscript in which somebody had probably very carefully typed it out, used the whiteout to make sure every word was spelled correctly. And I thought that's something every writer needs to see, is what goes on in the slush pile.
Well, it's pretty horrifying, and I've seen similar things. I know what you're talking about. I think sometimes, though, it's sort of horrifying how quickly you can tell if something's entirely right or entirely wrong. But often you don't see those extremes. You know, nothing is so horrible in the first paragraph, usually, that you want to throw it over your shoulder. On the other hand, very rarely does absolute brilliance leap out the instant your eyes focus on the page. I just think that the number of people writing and the amount of work that shows up in those offices must drive those people crazy on some level. It certainly would be more than I could deal with. And my only perspective on it really is that I taught for a number of years.
I have a question about the copyright of your book. It's held by Irony and Pity Incorporated.
It's my corporation. This was something that I did under the advice of an accountant many years ago. And when I came up with when I went to the lawyer's office and said, well, I'm incorporating as Irony and Pity, he said, how long do you think that will be funny? And I said, always. It still amuses me very much, but I've taken a lot of bashing for that. It's a line from a Hemingway novel, of course. Jake Barnes is sitting around with his friend in a bar in The Sun Also Rises, and the two of them are getting more and more blasted, and finally the line comes out, irony and pity, give him irony and pity. So I was giving the IRS irony and pity because my accountant said to do so.
You've said that when you get you like to write some snappy dialogue because you like to get a good line off now and again. You sit at the typewriter and laugh as you're writing?
Well, this will be turned against me, but yes, I often amuse myself. You know, the thing about writing is that it really is extremely lonely, and I guess that's fairly apparent. It didn't quite strike me that way until I spent 3 years working on this book and was really, in point of fact, you know, not going on vacation, not going out to dinner and so forth. But and also living in a small town again. I had moved from New York back to Charlottesville, which is a wonderful place to work because there are no distractions. And yet, if you want distractions, it's very nice to be able to go out and find them. And that's not terribly easily done there. But I think just the loneliness of it, I mean, in some ways you can try little systems that will amuse you and that will fire you up and keep you going. They may never be anything that seem terribly important to the reader, but to you, in jokes, I mean, even things like that, they'll keep you going. It's certainly, for instance, an in-joke of this book that one of my best friends is named Andrew Bornstein, and I have him make a cameo as a little boy rushing off an elevator holding an inflatable palm tree, and the mother screaming, "Andrew Bornstein, you come back here."
I think those are the things that you have to that keep you coming back to the typewriter.
Exactly, but as with any difficult thing, if you think about functioning through some four-hour period that's traumatic to you, you usually find your little touchstone or your little way around it to function through, and it's no different with writing.
What kind of photographs do you have on your icebox at home?
Somewhat lesser quality than are hung on the walls. Snapshots of friends, funny newspaper clippings.
Do you rotate what you have on your icebox?
Yeah, especially because the freezer part doesn't work, and when things get very wet up toward the top, they get taken off and new ones get put up there.
So you've got clippings and you've got photographs, refrigerator magnets. You have a collection of refrigerator magnets?
I do. My mother keeps me supplied with refrigerator magnets. It says something that she supplies me with typing paper and also refrigerator magnets.
Your mother supplies you with your typing paper?
That's right. Years ago when I moved to New York, she sent me a check for $20 and said, "Mama hopes that now you will go out to some lovely store in New York and buy your own typing paper." And I said, "No, go back to People's Drugstore in D.C., get more, $1.69, send it UPS. Writers are neurotic, what can I tell you?
I'll move on from the subject of photography here.
I thought maybe you were going to move on from the fact that I was cheap and my mother still supplied me with all these things.
Well, that's kind of an interesting connection. Was your mother instrumental in encouraging you to be a writer?
I don't think directly so, but she always read to me a lot. Both my mother and father read to me a lot. In fact, one of my father's favorite stories is that he tried to get me to be enthusiastic about going to kindergarten, saying that I could read the comic strips myself if I went to kindergarten. And I asked him what was wrong with the plan as it was currently operating, sitting on his lap and having them read to me. So I can't say that I was exactly ready to race out into the world and become anything, let alone a writer.
Well, Ann Beattie, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you for having me.
Short story writer and novelist Ann Beattie. Her latest novel is Picturing Will, and it's published by Random House. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later today here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, and host Robert Siegel has stopped by to give us a preview. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Sedge. We'll be hearing today about the conflict between President Bush and the Congress over extending the visas of Chinese students in this country. You may recall the Congress voted to do that. The president vetoed their bill, and now the Congress is expected to override the president's veto. Also, a talk with an Azeri dissident in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. She talks about some of the events there today. And also we'll be talking with Shintaro Ishihara, who's a member of the Japanese parliament and a writer and one of the authors of a book called A Japan That Can Say No.
Far-flung reports brought together later today on All Things Considered here on National Public Radio. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg recently caught a commercial on television that made him think about the way the rich and famous in this country like to set themselves apart by their titles.
Donald Trump has branched out, first into literature and now into board games. But he wants us to be reassured that these new ventures don't involve any base pecuniary motivations. This time he wants only our adulation, not our bucks. So he has the announcer say at the end of the TV ads for Trump the Game, "Mr. Trump will donate his profits from the sale of the game to charity." That's very decent of him, but what's this Mr. Trump business? It makes you wonder if Trump understands how celebrity works in a democratic society where the pretense is that we're all on a first-name basis. How far would Ed McMahon get if he started The Tonight Show, "Here's Mr. Carson"? Mr. is the form you use when you're talking about your employer. Mr. Trump has no statement at this time. Bring Mr. Trump's plane around to the dining room. The owner of the California Angels was just plain Gene in his first life as a singing cowboy, but now he has $3 million a year players calling him Mr. Autry when they talk to the press. And while movie stars are never called Mr. or Miss in the main credits, they somehow acquire those titles when it comes to describing their flunkies and service people. Miss Parton's hair by Osterizer, Mr. Stallone's wardrobe by Kenneth of Haiphong. Mr. and Miss are the deference exacted by power, not fame. Of course, Mr. and the rest are only polite when you're addressing somebody directly. And even in the third person, it's okay to use them if you spread them around. The New York Times gives everybody a title, from Mr. Gaddafi to Mr. Claus. You can almost hear the writers gnashing their teeth when they come up against a name that doesn't permit this treatment. If they could, they'd say Miss Cher or Mr. Sting. It's a harmless fiction the Times likes to indulge in, as if anybody fit for printing about must be a gentleman. There's a more curious use to Mr. and Miss, though, when they're used with both first and last names. This is something you hear when an MC is introducing an entertainer, particularly a singer. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ray Charles, or Mr. Lou Rawls, or for those old enough to remember, the singing rage, Miss Patti Page. Of course, not every singer gets this treatment. It's hard to imagine a concert beginning, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Boy George, or Miss Wendy O. Williams, or the Messer's Twisted Sister. And you wouldn't refer to Mr. Cool Moe D. In fact, you wouldn't use Mr. or Miss with any singer named D, not Joey D., Kiki D., or even Tommy D., whose 1959 hit Three Stars was a lugubrious meditation on the deaths of Mr. Buddy Holly, Mr. Richie Valens, and Mr. Big Bopper. Nor would you call him Mr. Mick Jagger, not even when introducing the song Miss Amanda Jones, or for that matter, Miss You. Mr. and Miss seem to go particularly well with Antime lounge singers, Mr. Jerry Vale, Miss Nancy Wilson. I've heard DJs use it to introduce Phil Collins, but then Phil Collins is basically just an Antime stadium singer. It suggests that the person you're talking about is what they call a singer's singer, which is a way of saying that those of us who like them must be listeners' listeners. That's why it's always Miss Peggy Lee and Miss Sarah Vaughan, who, by the way, had rival hits in 1956 with a song called Mr. Wonderful. And Mr. has become an inseparable part of Mel Torme's name, like Mr. Rogers, Mr. T, or Mr. Ed. And let's not forget Billy Eckstein, the fabulous Mr. B, who, after all, was the singer's singer's singer. Actually, it's kind of a nice convention, and I don't know why we use it only for singer's singers. Why not, ladies and gentlemen, the arms dealer's arms dealer, Mr. Adnan Khashoggi? Or, I give you the feminist feminist, Ms. Gloria Steinem. Or even, here he is now, the parvenu's parvenu, Mr. Donald Trump.
Mr. Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red. A horse is a horse, of course, of course. And no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is, of course, unless the horse is the famous Mr. Red.
Miss Amy Sallet and Miss Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Miss Sue Spolin does our research. Miss Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Mr. Sedge Thompson.
Yakety-yak and streak and waste your time of day. But Mr. Ed will never speak unless he has something to say. A horse is a horse, of course, of course. And this one will talk till his voice is hoarse. You never heard of a talking horse?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next time on Fresh Air, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews music of the 90s, two new rap albums. Stephen Schiff thrills us with insights on the new Spellbinder Everybody Wins, starring Nick Nolte and Deborah Winger. And we've penciled in Henry Petrosky to talk about the engineering marvel, The Pencil. That's next time on Fresh Air.